As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game with me, Gabriel Marcotti. My aim is to make sense of the weekend's biggest football action, and I am lucky enough to have the company via Skype, registered trademark, of Matt Dickinson, Tony Cascarino, and of course, Rory K. Smith. In 40 minutes' time, that should make everything crystal clear. Our focus today is on faltering Manchester City, rising Everton, and all that nuttiness that took place at the DW Stadium. I'll also be asking my panel why English sides have been not that impressive in the Champions League this year, or last year, or the year before. But let's start at Goodison, Everton and City. Now, Everton are kind of a bogey team for your mate, Roberto Mancini. Isn't that the case, Dicko?
We're very close. Very, very close. He was around yesterday for tea and muffins.
Why have the wheels come off at City? And I don't just mean like in terms of results, because the reality of the Premier League is, I think this season, and we'll get into this more, most of the top teams play badly. The difference is that this team seems to play badly and just not produce and not get...
Well, I think there's a lot of answers to that question in no particular order. We've seen Mancini, I think, wrongly keep harping back to transfers that didn't happen last summer. I think, you know, he's banged on more than he should have done about, you know, the fact that City didn't, having already assembled the most expensive squad of all time, should have gone out and spent another 50 million on Van Persie and Javi Martinez, etc. He spent too much time looking back and moaning about that. They've had problems with Yaya Toure going to the African Nations Cup, not coming back with the same, not playing nearly as well this season, individual losses of form, Joe Hart, individual loss of form. I think there's been a collective complacency at times, which again, you know, Mancini has moaned about and said that that's why you need extra signings. Well, you know, throwing money at it is the only solution to that problem. Then, you know, he's not half as good a manager as he'd like us to think he is. I think the team there's been a lack of pace about a lot of the teams he's picked. You know, we know he doesn't like orthodox wide players, but even by his standards, there's some of those teams he's selected have just looked really turgidly slow. And I would say Saturday's was one of them. I could go on.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with just about everything Dicko said, and I find it disappointing because, having seen Mancini in Italy, one of the things he was very good at is actually working with a team, working with what he had, and giving a team an identity, a way of playing. I think simply bad, stupid PR to go and keep going back to Marwood and Van Persie and whatever else, using that as a crutch. It's stupid PR to talk about Maicon and Rodwell being injured because, you know, with all due respect, like, did you really need these guys that much that, you know, they're crucial? There's still a bit of a mystery to me. If I was to ask you which City players have produced more this year, performed better this year than last year, you would argue Tevez for obvious reasons, but is there anybody else?
Well, I suppose Nastasic.
Because
he wasn't there, but in terms of someone who's been a success, Nastasic. And that's probably about it, isn't it, really? There's no one else who's
Cliche might have had a better
season. Cliche, maybe, yeah.
Jacko.
I mean, Zabaleta's been their best player this season.
Yeah, but Zabaleta was excellent last year as well, yeah. But in terms of Aguero and Silva, the one thing I would say about Mancini, even in winning the title, and this isn't meant to sound like being sort of wise after the event, even in winning the league last year, City really reminded me of Mancini's Inter in that they had quite a lot of good players and they were impressive on an individual basis, but I never actually felt, and you'll know much more about the his Inter team than I do, but that Inter side to me never looked like it had a plan beyond here are 11 good footballers, in some way we will win this match. And City, I think
you're thinking of late Inter,
possibly
of
later
Inter
on.
With Ibra.
Yeah, possibly.
Which is always a problem when you have that guy on the team. I mean,
but City looked like that to me last year as well, and even more so this year, except that the players aren't playing quite as well. I think Mancini's kind of constant, the tension that he seems to seek within his management has maybe influenced morale in the camp. They don't seem to have that fighting spirit. It may be, as Dicko says, complacency set in, that they felt that they could win games regardless, and it's just not happened for them. I think that their season now, 15 points, I think, is the same gap in England as there is in Scotland. That's pretty damning for Man City.
You're looking at me, Gab.
You sound like you have something to say, Cass.
Tony Castorino is going to speak.
Poor management, totally, from Saturday's perspective. Before the game, if you're a manager, like we all do prep work. We look at what we think we need to, you know, look out for. You know, as a manager, you look at the opposition, you think what are their strengths, what are their weaknesses. All that happens in the week leading up to a game. If you think you can enter a game on Saturday and play Everton and have no one oppose Leighton Baines and Seamus Coleman, who had the freedom to just run riot down the wings, then honestly, you've got it totally wrong. I can't believe Mancini has entered that game with a formation that allowed Everton to be just running at them at will, caused them so many problems. And I tell you what, even when it went to 10 men, I don't know about you guys, but I thought Everton was so comfortable with 10 men against the champions. He got it totally wrong. And he got it, I think, as poorly wrong Saturday as he's got it wrong all year. Yeah, they didn't have Aguero, they didn't have Yaya Toure, and yet players are not playing as well. But you've got to get it right. You've got to get your organisation. Wigan absolutely destroyed Everton the week before, 3-0 at Goodison. Their tactics were superb. They exactly stopped Everton doing what they're good at. And yet a week later, the champions go to Goodison and put in a performance where they just looked like they were bewildered. They didn't know, you know, where it was all coming from. And it was obvious. The two wide fullbacks are a major asset to Everton in the way they play.
Okay, but I love Seamus Coleman. Mm. I think... in a platonic sense.
Yeah.
Sometimes wish he moved to a different country where I think his skills would be more appreciated than here. But... we're not talking about somebody who's played at a Danny Alves type level all season long.
No.
So to some degree, it's like, oh look, what do we know about Coleman? Oh yeah, he's young, he's kind of inconsistent and stuff, and he's going to be playing out on the flank. I mean,
but you've got to try and stop what that Gab. We've seen enough of Everton. You know that's one of their strengths. Liam Baines goes up and down that wing. You have no one against them to stop them. You've got to put players to make them not do what they were doing. I'm sorry, you're going to fall flat on your face. If you think you're going to take on Everton in that manner and not get your tactics right, you were going to get what happened to them on Saturday.
Well, it's one of the problems, isn't it? I mean, the city being bogged down through a very narrow team. I mean, they played a narrow team a lot of last season as well, but they're playing, you know, as Tony says, it's not responding to the other team, and B, it's a lack of dynamism about them. I mean, I only saw the highlights, but I mean, there was an awful lot of standing still, even from watching those clips.
Well,
that speaks partly of tactics, but also does speak of, you know, and we hate to reduce the game to simplicities like hunger, but I'm afraid City have been repeatedly lacking in it.
And Matt, you touched on it earlier. You said they're quite ponderous. It reminded me of when Chelsea went Mikel Lampard, and they had that type of midfield where they had Garcia in midfield with Gareth Barry and Mill. It may just looked a bit ponderous, but you've got to stop Everton's width, the wide fullbacks. You've got to.
Just on the issue of ponderousness. Yeah, I mean, Yaya Toure obviously last year was kind of this force of nature who drove City to the FA Cup the year before, and then drove them to the title. I love Yaya both as a footballer and as a man, because he is a fantastic man in every single way. But Yaya looks like he's bulked up too much. He looks like he's been slowed down by his muscle mass, and that's true of quite a lot of City. They're a big side, and I think Mancini wanted that. But there is a balance to be struck. Gab looks very, very cynical about this. Or he's maybe not interested.
No. I am interested in what you have to say.
His looks of cynicism and boredom are very similar.
He's played in deeper in a lot of games I've seen as well. I mean, he's less. I mean, I thought that. I mean, one of the Mancini's greatest sort of hits of his time in England was reinventing Yaya as this rampaging. I mean, a sort of a number 10 of a type we'd never seen before.
Sorry if I jump in there, but I have to do it. I have to be sort of the Ponce Euro snob here. We had seen it, of course, Dicko, because as you know, that's the position he played when he played for Monaco, when we were all watching Ligue 1 back some sort of 7 or 8 years ago before he went to Barcelona.
Well, aren't you clever? Those of us who weren't watching French league football 87 years ago were struck by how because he didn't, when he first came, he didn't certainly play him in that role, and it sort of developed quite quickly. The fact that he was off playing in Africa for 6 weeks didn't help. But
he's not as fit, Matt. He's not as fit as he was last year.
No, I think
that's the big difference.
There will inevitably be talk about Manchester City finding a new manager. Fortunately, that whole idea that, you know, because Chiqui Beristain played with Pep Guardiola and worked with him, that Pep Guardiola should do everything that Chiqui says and come and join him at City. Hopefully, that whole theory's gone out the window now. But what does – Cass, I want to ask you, what does Mancini need to do between now and the end of the season? If you were Khaldun Al-Mubarak, considering what managers are available out there – what would he have to do between now and the end of the season for you to persuade him that he's the right person to continue this project?
Winner style football matches that are going to convince the owners that they will challenge next year.
Well, you're the owner in my scenario.
Well, I would be looking very closely at the next, 9 games to go. I'd be looking closely, you know, how they perform, how the team is looking tactically, players in general, looking at me individually. Is he overachieving? I think one of the biggest tests for managers is if you can overachieve with your personnel, what you're getting out of them. Are you getting the best out of them? Why are they not playing so well this year? So all them questions, they've got to perform to a very high level between now and the end of the season for the owners to go into next season with not feeling too bleak about things, with optimism that they can challenge again next year, because they have spent fortunes in many ways, wages and transfers, so they should be challenging.
The one thing I would say is that as far as we all know, the sort of noises coming out of City are that Al-Mubarak and I guess the Sheikh, I don't know how involved he is on a day-to-day basis, are still pleased with, like, it just rings up from Abu Dhabi, how Scott Sinclair trained. Khaldun Al-Mubarak and Mancini have a good relationship. The owners at City have faith with Mancini. They've been very keen in the past to sort of distance themselves from that Abramovich model of foreign ownership. Ooh. Where something goes wrong, sack the manager. And if you look around Europe, there's not, now that Pep's at Bayern, there's not necessarily a kind of standout candidate. I personally think City are a little bit beyond where they need Mourinho. I think they don't want that kind of figure. I think his, not only his relationship with Chiqui and with Ferran Soriano would count against him, but also the circus that comes with Mourinho, I think, is something City don't want.
I think Ducker's been saying that.
They say categorically that won't happen. Simple as that. I mean, the steers are always don't go there. So I mean, I agree with Rory. I mean, you have to, there's no point in getting rid of Mancini unless you're pretty sure you're upgrading now. The balance is pretty fine, I think. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to be frustrated, very frustrated by this season, but it's not so easy just to click your fingers and rustle up a better manager.
Cass, David Moyes obviously is taking till the end of the season of his contract. I feel like, you know, there's the same argument every year. Everybody says he's good and whatever else. If you were Ken Wright, and there's rumors of would he go for Roberto Martinez or stuff like that, do you think Ken Wright's thinking of a plan B in case Moyes doesn't come back?
Has to. You always have to be prepared with players, with managers. You have to be prepared to what you can lose, what you're going to get in, because I'm sure that Ken Wright will do his utmost.
Who has impressed you? You pay more attention to the lower leagues than I do. Anybody impress you?
What, as a manager?
Yeah, apart from Roberto Martinez, which is pretty obvious, and I think also given he turned down Liverpool a year ago, I don't know that.
No, I think he'd probably go this summer, Roberto. I think he probably knows that.
But not to Everton, obviously.
No, I think he'd go to Everton. I think Everton would be the right job for him.
Why would he go to a club that clearly, I mean, couldn't? I'm not disrespecting Everton here, but Everton obviously have are you know, they're kind of in a financial straitjacket because of the situation.
Yeah, but the problem is that with Wigan, as much as Martinez feels as though he owes a debt,
I'm not suggesting he should stay at Wigan, but surely he can do better than Everton.
Well, he possibly could, but this summer we don't know. It always depends what job comes up, and I think he probably knows that this is the time that he can't kind of twist again. It's time to kind of to take the job that comes up. If you look at what else might come up this summer, what else is there? Well, in terms of the lower leagues, though, which was your initial question, I think if you look at, there's obviously people like Zola at Watford who's doing quite a good job. Gus Poyet at Brighton and maybe a big contender. Gary Rowett's taken Burton to second in League Two. It depends how much they want to gamble. There's not that many young English managers out there young British managers to repeat the trick that Ken Wright pulled off with Moyes 10 years ago. There's not many. Uwe Rosler, he's doing quite well.
He's another young British manager, isn't he, with a name.
Oh,
like,
and
that.
There's Eddie Howe at Bournemouth as well. He's quite good, isn't he? Eddie Howe's alright.
Right. Who won League 2 last year? He might be available.
Oh, some Italian. Yeah, exactly. Fascist salute.
Exactly, yeah. There you go. How original. All right, but we were talking about Roberto Martinez, which provides a natural segue on to Wigan and Newcastle. I think there's one place to start with a big talking point from this game. Callum McManaman's tackle on Masadio Haidara, the young 20-year-old Frenchman who was making, I believe, only a second or third appearance for the club and who, of course, came on for Debushi. Dicko, I want to start with you because all right, there's commitment, there's whatever else. I guess we'll talk about what might have gone through his mind. But I'm going to start first of all, you need to pick on a referee again. In fact, how could the referee not have given a foul for this? Because all I can think of, if you don't give a foul for this, then you assume that one of the two players got the ball and there was no contact and that Haidara didn't just go and somehow injure himself, right?
Well, you could argue basically if he doesn't give anything, then that's almost more reassuring is the fact that he's seen nothing. I mean, we're still waiting to hear exactly what he did or didn't see. From the clips, what is sort of harder to understand is that the linesman, as far as we could see, was not only had the perfect view, but was, again, from the highlights, seemingly looking exactly in that direction. He was following the ball. So, you know, what Halsey did or did not see, you know, at the moment, well, so you feel that if he's given nothing, you have to give him the sort of benefit of the doubt that he didn't really have the right, wasn't in the right place or was blocked or whatever. But why, you know, just a linesman, you know, whether he doesn't have the confidence, whether he just, what he saw, how he saw it, how he interpreted it. But generally, linesmen, whether they've got the confidence to actually flag something as big as that, to tell a referee that he should be sending off something, effectively to be sort of overruling the referee, I don't think enough of that goes on. I think there's a bit of a sort of, you know, hierarchy there that linesmen are reluctant to get involved in.
But that's bizarre because they generally work with the same people most of the time, don't
they?
Well,
exactly, but I think, you know, I mean, obviously they have different relationships with different referees, but it's impossible to know until you were in Halsey's sort of, you know, in his boots and had his line of vision. But say, from what we can see, the linesman saw it, and God knows why he's not getting involved.
It's a stupid thing to do. He should be punished. But let's not sort of castigate him as though he's sort of inherently evil. It's just it happens.
Exactly. And then, you know, we're all sort of, I mean, I agree with Rory, it suddenly becomes this sort of search for the inner soul of a young kid who we don't, you know, no one knows. I mean, you know, Martinez comes out and says he's not that type of lad, and then that will be picked apart as sort of, what type of lad is he? You know, I agree. I think it's, you know, the punishment will not just come from the authorities, but in the sort of huge exposure that this has got, you know, all over the back pages. He'll be asked about it everywhere he goes. There's that. He's got to handle that, and in some way, that's punishment enough.
I agree with that, and I just, part of the reason why I kind of went through this with Cass beforehand was to sort of establish that there's no level of premeditation here. It's not retaliation.
No.
This is just somebody who made a bad judgment call on the day, did something dangerous. I do think that, you know, we probably do have to really disincentivize this because these are professional athletes. They're coordinated people. They control their bodies. Without the reason we have bans for this sort of thing and longer than usual bans is to have a situation where, you know,
people won't take chances like that in trying to win the ball, right? Isn't that?
Yeah.
That's because this is how people can get better.
But there's another kind of aspect to it, which is that element of the game is now very old-fashioned. And I know this is something that me and Tony talked about in the past, that tackling, if you look at the whole development of pressing, is to take the need out to tackle. So take out the fact that Manaman sort of smashes into Haidara's knee. What if Haidara skips past him? Which is what would, you know, it was a bad tackle in the sense that it was poorly timed. Haidara just clips the ball away, beats McManaman. What McManaman should be doing, and I'm sure Roberto Martinez would have told his players, just Widdon press, is get to the man and don't let him pass you. Block the cross. Don't dive in. The game is developing beyond the point where tackles like that are even relevant. So you're absolutely right. We do have to kind of to ban players to say, look, you're not to do this. This is dangerous. You're endangering other people's careers. But also, I think the game is changing to the point where it will happen less and less anyway.
I just said on the fact that Martinez took him off, 15, 20 minutes into the second half, you could tell from the half time, that John Carver incident going down the tunnel and what happened afterwards, what we don't know, but the kid was clearly affected by everything.
Yeah,
it's hard to, people are not going to really sympathise with someone that's putting such a poor challenge. Right.
But let's be clear, we're not talking, he's not Kevin Muscat.
No, absolutely not. No, we certainly don't feel like that way.
By the way, just on Carver,
can you just explain, great facts, since you seem to be very well knowledgeable, can you just explain for the benefit of our listeners about what happened?
So at halftime, before halftime, John Carver was on who's the Newcastle first team coach, I think is his official title. He was on the touchline, clearly very agitated. He then didn't confront the referee, he confronted Callum McManaman as he walked towards the tunnel in sort of puce-faced, pointy-fingered rage. It went on. He had to be held back by stewards. He was having, I think, he had a shoving match with Graham Barrow, who's the Widdon first team coach. And Carver, there was allegedly an altercation in the tunnel as well. Carver was sent to the stands, and so was Barrow. Although Barrow seemed to be sent sort of to the roof of the DW Stadium, which is to God knows what he did. Carver got quite a nice seat, and Barrow stood up there in the gantry, not even allowed to sit down. That's a real, but that is a genuine punishment. But I just on that, it was a bad tackle. What Carver did is disgraceful, because that happens, as Cass says, that happens to players from every team. Do you know what I mean? Your one day, one of John Carver's players will put in a bad tackle.
Goodbye.
Yeah. Kabai's
done about four of them already.
I love Johan Kabai as a player, but he's not averse to putting a stud in. It's the hypocrisy and the inability to control their tempers is complete. Is rank.
Tico, I don't know John Carver, but as I understand, you guys used to be part of the same bridge team. So I'll chuck this to you. If this were in Italy, I would assume that what Carver was trying to do is unsettle McManaman, because by that point, he's halftime, presumably he's cooled down, and he's having a go at him to try to mess with a young kid's mind, so he's going to be rubbish in the second half. Now, you guys, of course, don't have those dark hearts, those dark arts here in England, or do you? Or is that what Carver might have been doing?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. It's a bit of, I don't know if he's sort of playing to the cameras. Wasn't Bobby Robson once trying to hold a press conference at an airport once and then behind the door there was Carver and Craig Bellamy throwing furniture at each other or something. I'm sure there's a story.
Right, I have some memory.
We need to get Cork onto that. I'm 99% sure that there was a situation with Bobby Robson trying to conduct where there was a sort of sound of flying chairs from behind the door, and sort of Bobby sort of shrugged his shoulders and basically said, yeah, that'll be my assistant and star striker sorting out their differences. So he's got a bit of form for, shall we say, temper issues, I think, and as is Craig Bellamy for that matter. But if I was the Newcastle bench, I'd have been upset. I think they're, if you give them a bit of slack, they're entitled to look at, they saw the replay obviously soon after the incident, they're there, they're steaming, they think one of their players has taken a serious injury from a seriously bad.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Tackle, you know, tempers are allowed to...
This is like 10 minutes after the fact, though, right?
Well, yeah, and then, and he's, you know, it's a pretty unedifying scene of a guy trying to intimidate
disgraceful, you know, in fact, is what Rory K. Smith called.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I think it was, you know, it was unedifying, unappealing, but, you know, worth... It's We see it most weeks, don't we? Some dressing, sort of handbags going on. It wasn't as if it became fisticuffs on the pitch.
We'll get into this more, but this is a good opportunity. Unless somebody really feels like they need to talk about Maynard Figueroa's handball leading to Rudy Coney's goal, no, we don't, because we love Roberto Martinez. Want to stay up, and even if he has to cheat, it's okay. Because hey, Newcastle, you're fine. You can afford to give up the points. But let's talk relegation though, because Wigan are still in the bottom three. It's still a 3-point gap with Villa, although of course they do have that game in hand. I'm kind of surprised by how sort of like week on week, like things seem to change. We'll get to this too, but QPR like won 2 games in a row and all of a sudden like, oh, Harry's going to do it. Harry Houdini, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, then they lose this weekend. Reading, of course, they've got this horrible run of games and they don't have a proper manager. You chuck all this stuff in there. I think we have a perception that Villa and Southampton are going to stay up along with Wigan. Is that right? Does anybody dare disagree with me there?
Well, they kind of can't. All three of them can't stay up, can they?
Oh, they can.
If Sunderland or West Ham or...
Someone above them.
But that's what...
I think you will find Sunderland and Southampton have the same number of points. Sunderland, you know, I know it seems weird. Sunderland are on, unless my table in the Times is wrong... There seems to be a general perception that Wigan, Villa, and Southampton are going to stay up, that QPR and Reading are going to go down, and that Sunderland are the team that, you know, they're not even getting sucked in there. They have been sucked. They're right.
They're
the same number of points
as
Southampton.
I defer to Cass on this one, but what he's about to say is perfectly correct.
Are you going to have a go at Martin O'Neill?
No. I tell you what was pretty astounding watching him, you know, against Norwich was the fact that Danny Graham's come in, looks all out of sorts, look like the transfer's affected him. He doesn't look like players played in and out of the team for Swansea all year.
You don't
year.
Think it's because he's a Newcastle fan that he's trying to purposely get Sunderland relegated?
Good idea, Gab. Also, more worryingly, Stephen Fletcher's totally gone off the boil. You know, he's been kept quiet by the Danny Graham signing, but he's gone way off the pace. Adam Johnson's performing indifferently. So there's lots of worrying signs. They're losing football matches, Sunderland, and now they go a fixture run of 3 very, very tough games where they could easily not get any points from, which could easily put them again in it. I looked at the performance yesterday and watching both games, I was like, God, Wigan look a far better team than Sunderland. And they're just behind them. So I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Villa got away with a game. They got away with it because they could have easily been out of sight, you know, in the first half against QPR. QPR could have been winning that quite comfortably and have ended up Villa nicking the game from a mistake. But Cesar, you know, performed miracles. But Sunderland would be my real worry because they're a team out of form and they've got 3 horrendous fixtures coming.
But there's others as well. If you look, me and Tony were looking at the table earlier. Is it between 12th and 7th? Between 8th?
Up to Stoke.
Yeah, it's up to Stoke. Stoke got 34, I think. You'd presume Fulham on 36 are away. Stoke got 34, and there's, I think, 7 teams who could all get sucked into it. West Ham aren't playing well. Sunderland aren't playing well.
Well, especially
Norwich aren't playing
if Wigan have a run, they're the ones who've got 27 but got a game in hand. If they have a run, that drags all of that pack of 6 or 7 teams into it.
Let's go back and talk big clubs, big four type clubs, historically big clubs who underachieve. Yes, I'm talking about you, Liverpool. First time since 1996, no English sides have made the Champions League quarterfinals. Between 2006 and 2009, Premier League clubs supplied 9 of the 12 semifinalists. Since then, I think they've only had 4. I think in the next 4 years, counting this one, because obviously there will be no semifinalists this year. So I've always argued that performance in European competition doesn't really tell you much about the strength of a league and yada, yada, yada. Some people disagree. Rory, you're looking interested. Where do you stand?
I think performance in the Champions League tells you a lot about, this sounds really obvious, about the strength of the elite of the league. You can judge the strength.
You copied that from me.
Possibly. I copy a lot of things from you, Dab. You're essentially my hero. You could say that the lead is only as strong as its weakest link. So the best way to tell is to see who's, you know, which lead has the strongest bottom placed club. You could say that it would be the bulk of teams.
That would be such a stupid thing.
What a great competition that would be! What a brilliant competition if, like, who's bottom in Serie A?
Palermo.
So if Palermo stronger than QPR?
Palermo have had 6 managers this year, so they obviously.
But none of them have been Harry, which is the big problem.
This is true.
You could say that the I guess the bulk of the strength is the teams in the middle, because that's the kind of the bulk of the lead. I think what's interesting about the Champions League is if you look at the time when English teams were most dominant, they were never really truly dominant. They only won it twice. That's a weird kind of dominance. There was the same 4 teams in it all the time, whereas the Spanish and the Italians were sending 2 teams who were the same and then kind of had a rotating cast of others. So you had Celta Vigo and Real Betis and Sociedad and Udinese were in it for a bit and blah, blah, blah. So what happened...
Udinese were in it this year.
Yeah, that's true. So what happens when you have that sort of situation is that you get 2 teams who do well, like Barcelona and Real Madrid, and 2 teams who kind of don't, they're not used to it, they don't really have the players, they struggle with the schedule, blah, blah, blah. England is now more in that situation than the situation where you have 4 teams who are always in it, so players know they can go to those clubs because they will be in the Champions League. They're used to the schedule, all that. So it's changed. The Premier League's got more democratic, is what I've just spent a long time saying.
Dicko?
That's partly it. I think it's, we've all been sort of casting around for trends, and I see a trend in the sense of, I don't think there's a particularly good top club. There's not a great side in England at the moment, but I think mostly it comes down to individual reasons. You know, the problems at Manchester City are very different from the problems at Chelsea. The problems at Arsenal are very different from the problems at Manchester United.
I wrote a column on this very issue yesterday, in fact, and that's exactly the argument I made.
Yeah, well, bloody hell. We're
great minds. Well, I think what you're saying is, if you look at the sort of, you know, the tops, in fact, I'm going to call it a top 6 by revenue here in England, which includes a top 5 plus Liverpool. Probably every single one of them, with the exception of Spurs, can say, we're playing worse football this year. We're worse off this year. Than we were last year. You might make a slightly different argument for United, but even United certainly aren't playing particularly well. And of course, they're in a situation where they've got a lot of rebuilding ahead. So the one other thing I throw in there, though, Cass, which I think comes into this as well, certainly if you look at the quarterfinalists this year, is you have a situation where some of the foreign clubs, some of those teams that have reached the quarterfinals, have done exceptionally well. I mean, this Real Madrid side, you know, they had the most expensively assembled team in history in Pellegrini's first year, and then they went out and spared no expense to get the most expensive manager in European football. This Barcelona side is coming off the back of arguably, you know, the greatest 4-year stint of any club in the history of the world. This Juventus side is a tremendous investment in them. This Bayern side, you know, I think was also a tremendous investment. Even teams like Galatasaray, you know, they're able to find enough money to go and get to
Snyder sort of, and Drogba.
To expensive rentals. Snyder hasn't really done anything yet, but, you know, he's there. So you have this weird sort of combination. And Paris Saint-Germain, of course, you know, we know the situation there is that. It's not that the rest of Europe is catching up the way Wenger said, perhaps, but there are a number of elite sides who are a lot better.
Well, I touched on something with Rory last week, and the resources, like you said, at these clubs are huge and far bigger than they've been in years before. The one thing that stood out for me is that where I think football's evolved in Europe better, that we've fallen behind and they've learnt on us. And I chatted to Rory and I said, do you know what? The biggest change I've seen in football is without the ball. Without the ball, these teams in Europe are far better than we were. If you'd imagined a Manchester United team not having a Roy Keane, a Paul Ince, a Brian Robson, you know, that type of player. Wenger talked in the week about the other teams of Cuba. I remembered his Gilberto and Vieira partnership was the literally the infrastructure of a great side. But I think we've lost the ability without the ball. And that's been a huge change for Premiership football for me. It's been a massive change. And I think we've fallen behind big style. They've got fantastic at it. Whether it was just Barcelona and everybody cloning around it, a lot of these teams, and Juve again, are a great example. Yes, they put the investment in, and it's been huge. But that side, when you got the ball, they are at you from everywhere. And I think we've just fallen behind. There's too many of our teams are too easy to play against, and I think that showed in the Champions League matches that we saw recently.
It would be wise, I think, for the English teams to all watch the quarterfinals very carefully, because there's a lot of teams there that they could learn from. I think what Wenger said was slightly disingenuous and designed purely as a diversionary technique to prevent people talking about the fact that Arsenal will go for an eighth season without a trophy, despite a creditable win in Munich. But I don't know. Gab, you're the king of the Euro snobs. Do you not think that there is an element of kind of because the Premier League had so much money for so long that there was this idea that, you know, United, Arsenal, Chelsea, and Liverpool would buy in the best players from Europe while they were the big four, and then City came along and did the same thing. That other countries, with the exception of Barca and Real, where there isn't as much money in the game in terms of TV revenue and what have you, they've had to innovate much more, and the Premier League's got a little bit complacent with the style of play that we have and that we pride ourselves on. Teams like Dortmund and Juve have had to go to coaches who are a bit different, who've got different ideas, and they've had to kind of take the game onto to another level.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a reason why people say necessity is the mother of invention. You know, you mentioned Dortmund there. I think, again, that's sort of a unique case because, you know, they had arguably the best collection of young talent of any club side in Europe. That was built over time, and that was built because they spent years overspending, and they were kind of hamstrung. I do think there were teams in England that have done things that are interesting. I still think what Brendan Rodgers is trying to do is interesting. I think what Stoke does, even though everybody laughs at it, I think at least is interesting because it's different than what, you know, most other football clubs do. And Dicko, I want to get you on this.
Well, I was just spending a bit of follow up on that, but I mean, I agree with. I mean, it's a good point. I mean, you look at Arsenal in particular. I mean, the on the sort of complacency allegation. The fact is that they've been, you know, they've pitched their ambitions at you know, third or fourth, and been, you know, not without the odd squeak, and certainly not this, you know, certainly sort of squeaking this season more, and had problems last season and occasionally. But if you're pitching your ambitions at that, then clearly you're not, you know, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be contesting for the Champions League itself. So there's been a degree of complacency, which is why I say it seemed a bit sort of rich of Wenger, of all people, sort of talking about it as if, wow, you know, this is a slap in the face, you know, suddenly we've got to wake up. I mean, you know, if it was a slap in the face for any club, it's Arsenal above all, isn't it?
Gentlemen, we have to move on. I think what is an undeniable fact, though, is if you look at the top five in the Premier League this year, and with the exception of Tottenham, none of those teams, I think, has had any kind of coherent tactical evolution. They all have major problems on the pitch tactically, and I think it's something that they all need to work for. Pounded at the San Siro by one of the worst Inter teams in recent memory, defeated at home by Fulham, and to add insult to injury, a Berbatov goal. Rory, I think you referred to him as a ghost, so imaginative, in your piece today. Give me some good reasons to believe why this won't all end with another typical Tottenham collapse.
I'm not sure I will if you don't insult my copy. They're better.
Why do you see sarcasm when there isn't one?
They're better than they used to be. They've got a good squad. I think probably outside United, they're the best first 11 in England. They've got Gareth Bale, who's obviously probably the standout player alongside Suarez and Van Persie of this season. But at the same time, there is definitely a psychological element to the run-in. And speaking to Villas-Boas yesterday, you could tell that there was a slight element of doubt starting to creep into his mind that it might all happen again. I don't think it will, but Spurs need to sort of arrest their slump very, very quickly.
Dimitar Berbatov, the galloping ghost. As some people like to call them. Manchester United have pretty much locked up the title after the 1-0 win over Reading. But, Dicko, what's going on with Robin van Persie in the past 7 games? He has scored as much as you have, and he has just won, in fact, in the past 2 months.
This is where you're wrong, because yesterday, ball comes over, far post, who rises to head it home, but... Well, I can't be humble any longer. Me, who, winning 4-1, gives the ball 25 yards out, beats a man, ping, top corner, bang, 2 goals in a 5-1 victory.
I don't know that playing in your back garden with your kids qualifies.
Excuse me, this was 11v11, full-size pitch, massive, massive game, Sheen Mount Primary versus East Sheen Primary, local derby.
And on you play for a primary school.
No, the fathers, for God's sakes. Get it right. I beat a team of 10-year-olds. anyway, I scored two finally. So I am outscoring Robin van Persie. But I'm not going to diss him, because he's the nearest thing we've had to the almighty Dennis Bergkamp. And that's good enough for me. He'll be back. But again, make sure you leave that stuff in about my goals. It won't ever happen again.
No question. Thank you for your insight on why Robin van Persie has scored once in the last 2 months. Mostly just talk about yourself. Now, you're up next, Cass. If you like, you can tell us about the goals you scored, except, of course, you actually scored them against professionals, not suburbanites in southwest London. But or you may prefer just talk about Liverpool. Southampton, in fact, pummel Liverpool, just as some of us thought that the Reds had turned the corner. Cass, what I especially don't understand is why Rodgers thought it would be a good idea to play Joe Allen and Steven Gerrard together as part of a two-man central midfield.
Well, he went that option at the start of the season. It didn't really work. Gerrard underperformed alongside Joe Allen. Joe Allen's found it very difficult to settle in at Liverpool and do what he's good at, getting the ball down, moving it quickly. Got to give a lot of credit to Southampton. I thought they were superb. Didn't think that Liverpool would lose the game. But it came down to some really good individuals, and particularly Ricky Lambert. You know, not the quickest, but, well, did he have an impact on the game.
After QPR's back-to-back wins, everybody jumped on the Harry bandwagon. Rory, are you on board with the Harry Houdini Express, despite this defeat against Villa? Or will you join me in celebrating Paul Lambert?
Yeah, when QPR won their two games in a row, I've got to admit, at that point, having thought all season long they were down, I thought they might get out of it. But you looked at that gap, it's 7 points to
7 points
but there's they've got 8 games left.
You can see them
making that up. I've got to admit, you can see them making that up, but I don't know, I think QPR is really fascinating. I still think they could, not necessarily because of Harry, and I'm certainly not kind of a Redknapp worshipper, but I think they could still stay up. But at the same time, it looks like the teams from Wigan upwards are starting to sort of gather a bit of momentum. They're starting to realise that things are fairly urgent. That might just do for QPR.
Consecutive 2-0 away wins for Arsenal after mighty Bayern Munich, the best side in Germany. It's Swansea, the best side in Wales. Dicko, are Arsenal actually any better? Because I was at the Liberty Stadium and I thought they were still pretty poor.
Did I mention I scored 2 goals yesterday, by the way?
That's right, yes.
Going back to that, no, I was certainly in Munich, and I failed to get excited by the last 2 minutes, maybe. But I thought Bayern were beyond awful, beyond dreadful, and Arsenal were sort of okay. I couldn't get thrilled by their performance. Giroud was pretty lousy. I thought, apart from Cazorla, to be honest, going forward, they they stunk in that game. And, you know, the credit where it's due, he's changed the keeper, he's dropped Vermaelen, the back four seems to have finally worked out what they're meant to be doing. But so there's some, yeah, there's some advance, but I'm not, I'm with you. I don't think they're playing still that well despite the two wins.
Cass, Chelsea win again, capping a week in which they come back. Rafa Benitez said that it was a great three games. I think he means it's a great 2.5 games for them. But will you join me in celebrating, since we're in such a celebratory mood today, will you join me in celebrating Frank Lampard 200 goals for Chelsea?
Incredible achievement. Frank's got goals. I think he's made the best out of what he's got. I think that's been well
done. You knew him when he was a kid, right?
Well, I've met Frank. I've had a phone call from Frank, not a very nice one.
He's nice now. He was mean when he rang you up. But then you knew him before, right, when he was nice?
Yeah, he's an okay lad. I mean, hey, I judge him on a footballer.
Right.
That's what he is, and he's a very good one that's got, you know, double-digit figures every year, and we have to give him huge praise for achieving such goals. And tell you what, whoever does get him in the summer is going to get ahead of a player for a year.
Were he to go to another Premier League club?
There'd be loads after him.
But if he was to choose to go to another Premier League club, would it somehow tarnish his legacy a little bit, or in the eyes of fans? I mean, what I mean is that something that comes into consideration to you as a footballer, your relationship with supporters and stuff?
I think deep down you have to look at the bigger picture, and I think the intelligent fan will respect his decision. He's been a fantastic servant for Chelsea Football Club, something that West Ham didn't feel with their fans. You know, they give him abuse every game, every time he plays them. But Frank's, he's been, a great performer in many, many ways in his ability to get goals and be part of a team. He's made the most out of his career.
Gab, I have one for you. I hear Francesco Totti set another record this past weekend. You've already talked our ears off about him in the past, but I guess you want to talk more Totti, which is why you put this question in the script and put that back heel on Twitter last night.
That's entirely correct. Roma beating Parma 2-0 on Saturday night. Francesco Totti scoring on a free kick, goal number 226 in Serie A. He is now on his own, the number two leading goal scorer. Only needs another 48 goals to become number one, and he's only 36 years old, Cass.
That's what I was going to ask. I was going to say, has he got time?
I figure, you know,
48 goals,
24 goals a season the next 2 years. Why not?
Doable.
Anyway, he played a fantastic game, emotional game, and there is this brilliant bit of skill, which Rory, you appreciate. Perhaps you'd like to describe it.
Yeah. So he's he sort of gets the ball maybe sort of 10 yards inside the Parma half, played to him from the left wing, and he kind of, first time, he twists his body and flicks it with, it's not quite a back heel, it's with the outside of his boot. I can't really describe it. Put it into YouTube, it's extremely impressive. And then put in Rodrigo Tadé and Aurelio, which Gab instructed me about today, which is equally impressive.
Of course, the Rodrigo Tadé Aurelio is about 10 years old, but it is one of the most impressive bits of skill you will ever see. That's all we've got for this week. It's been fun. It's been real. Thanks to my guests, Tony Cascarino, Matt Dickinson, and, of course, Rory K. Smith. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts or email us, as so many of you do every single week. It's gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find news, views, web chats, blogs. On Tuesday, you get a double dose of me because I have both my blog, where I'll no doubt rant about something, and also my web chat, where I'll be measured and calm and cool and connected. We're all on Twitter except for Cass, so you can share your thoughts with Rory, Dicko, and myself. If you want to share your thoughts with Cass, why don't you go to his house? It's 18 Mill Lane, Surbiton. No, I'm just kidding. That's not really your address, is it?
No, 19. No.
19, there you go. Till next time, bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.